This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. President Joe Biden has invoked the Defense Production Act because of the serious infant formula shortage. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
President Joe Biden has invoked the Defense Production Act to help tackle the infant formula shortage. The order requires suppliers to fulfill orders from formula manufacturers before other customers. The president is also authorizing the Defense Department to use commercial aircraft to fly formula supplies that meet federal standards from overseas to the U.S. The White House is calling it Operation Fly Formula. A February shutdown of the Abbott Nutrition plant in Sturgis, Michigan, due to contamination issues, severely cut into supplies of baby formula. The FDA okayed the reopening of the plant this week, but Abbott said it will take 8 to 10 weeks before new product begins arriving in stores. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Russia says that nearly 1,000 Ukrainian troops who doggedly defended a giant steelworks in Mariupol have surrendered. The plant became a symbol of their country's resistance. The announcement Wednesday comes as the battle for the strategic port city appeared all but over. Ukraine ordered the fighters to save their lives and said their mission to tie up Russian forces is now complete. The fighters face an uncertain future. The Russian Defense Ministry spokesperson said 959 Ukrainian troops have now abandoned the stronghold since they started coming out Monday. Meanwhile, the first captured Russian soldier to be put on trial by Ukraine on war crimes charges pleaded guilty of killing a civilian and could get life in prison. Finland and Sweden, meantime, applied to join NATO, abandoning the generations of neutrality for fear of Russian President Vladimir Putin. This is VOA News. The United States struggled Wednesday to get clarity from Turkey over the severity of its opposition to Finland and Sweden joining NATO, as Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan took an increasingly tough line against their membership bids. In a meeting with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken at the United Nations, his Turkish counterpart offered mixed signals. The Turkish foreign minister affirmed his country's support for NATO's open-door policy and its understanding of Finland and Sweden's desire to join the alliance following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But he also repeated Erdogan's demand that Turkey's security concerns about the candidate's nation be addressed. Without acknowledging Erdogan's complaint about Finland and Sweden, Blinken stressed that Washington would work to ensure the NATO expansion process is successful. U.S. health authorities are warning of a resurgence of a virus pandemic. We get more on that story from AP correspondent Sagar Magani.
Health officials say America's virus pandemic could get worse in coming weeks and bring with it a return to mask recommendations.
There's a lot of infections across America.
White House Virus Response Chief Ashish Jha notes a steady increase the past 5 weeks, 26% just last week. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky says nearly a third of Americans now live in areas with medium or high COVID-19 community levels, where they are high.
We urge local leaders to encourage the use of prevention strategies like masking in public indoor settings.
Walensky says hospitalization rates are also up 19% in the past week, but still much lower than during the Omicron wave. Sagar Magani at the White House.
U.S. intelligence, shows there could be a North Korean nuclear test or a long-range missile test or both before, during, or after President Biden's trip to South Korea and Japan starting this week, according to National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. The White House said Biden would not visit the demilitarized zone that divides North and South Korea during his visit to South Korea, which begins on Friday, having said last week he was considering such a trip. Biden's May 20th through the 24th trip will be his first to Asia as president. It will include his first summit with the South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, who took office back on May 10th and has vowed a harder line against North Korean provocations. I'm Michael Brown reporting by remote, VOA News.
Thank you. Today is Thursday, May 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the U.S. National Security Chief warns of a possible North Korean nuclear test during President Joe Biden's trip to Asia.
They're also preparing for all contingencies, including the possibility, rather, that this might happen during Biden's trip and coordinating with allies in the region. That would include Korea.
The U.S. government gives more than $100 million to African states to fight terrorism.
Security leaders from the global coalition to defeat ISIS pledge to support African security agencies in dealing with the terrorist activities of the Islamic State.
And the U.S. Soccer Federation reaches milestone agreements to pay its men's and women's teams equally. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan has warned there could be a North Korean nuclear test or missile test or both before, during, or after President Joe Biden's trip to South Korea and Japan starting this week. Sullivan said the United States was coordinating closely with South Korea and Japan on the issue and had also discussed North Korea with his Chinese counterpart, Yang Jianqi, in a phone call on Wednesday. White House spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre said Biden would not visit the demilitarized zone or DMZ that divides North and South Korea during his trip to South Korea, which begins on Friday. For more, I spoke with VOA's White House correspondent Anita Powell.
They're also preparing for all contingencies, including the possibility, rather, that this might happen during Biden's trip and coordinating with allies in the region. That would include Korea and Japan. So that is what the U.S. is doing to kind of get ahead of it, I suppose. And they're also, as Jake Sullivan said, prepared to make adjustments to the military posture. As you know, there are several thousand U.S. troops stationed in South Korea. So that's probably what he's referring to.
And what about the timing? One would suppose that such a security threat would be kept quiet. Any reason why the White House decided to go public on this?
It is possible that this is why the president is not going to the DMZ. That was announced today by his new spokesperson, Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre. She said President Biden will not be going to the DMZ on this trip, which is a place that he visited when he was vice president. So that might be part of it, just letting us know that, you know, this is why they don't want to go too close to North Korea during this trip, because of this risk. The U.S. has been pretty open about telegraphing North Korea's moves and the issues that they're dealing with, including this current COVID outbreak. So I think that's part and parcel of how the administration probably sees North Korea.
Why is the president going to Asia?
This is Joe Biden's first trip as president to Asia. He's going first to South Korea to meet with the president, and he's going to attend a Quad summit. That is a grouping of Asia Pacific nations plus Australia. And he's going to basically, according to the White House, the priority is to just shore up those security alliances in the region and work on just containing China, which is the biggest competitor of the U.S. And as Biden has said very many times, competition is okay, conflict is not. And so he wants to just remind those allies in the region that the U.S. is allied with them and is supportive of them and is committed to keeping China from becoming a bigger threat.
Anita, what is the White House defense to those who say President Biden is going to Asia, but he has not gone to Ukraine?
I asked Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre about this the other day, if President was going to Ukraine. And here's the thing about a trip to Ukraine. The President does want to go to Ukraine. He has said this. He said, I'm keen to go there. He went there as vice president. But it is frankly very logistically difficult and dangerous for a president to go to a war zone, especially one where there aren't any U.S. troops on the ground and there isn't any U.S. control over airspace. And so for President Biden to go to Ukraine at this time would be a massive security undertaking. It would have to be necessarily shrouded in security. And I spoke to a presidential historian who took me through all of the memorable trips that presidents have made to war zones. And he noted that it doesn't really move the needle. It doesn't really give a huge payoff because you're just signaling to people at home that you are serious, that you are engaged in this matter. But that doesn't really seem to be necessary at this point in time, with Congress so overwhelmingly approving of all of the extra funding that Biden has asked for Ukraine.
That's VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell speaking with me from Washington, D.C. Finland and Sweden on Wednesday formally applied to join the NATO alliance at Allied headquarters, a decision spurred by Russia's invasion of Ukraine and setting in motion an accession process that is expected to take only a few weeks. To discuss the developments and its implications, Flashpoint's Ukraine Steve Miller speaks with Greg Albert, a political science professor at Augusta University in Georgia.
The implications are profound. The first implication is that President Putin is going to readjust the narrative on this and say, see, we needed to invade Ukraine because NATO does seek enlargement. So that's not how it happened, right? NATO is seeking enlargement for Finland and Sweden because President Putin attacked Ukraine. And so Finland and Sweden were starting to get worried that they could be next and that they needed some security guarantees and protection from President Putin or a future president of Russia from doing the same to them. But the narrative setting is what's important here, because Putin will use this as further justification of what happened in Ukraine. He will certainly perceive this as more of a security threat to Russia moving into the future.
Russia now has full control of Mariupol. All the defenders in the Azovstal steel and ironworks plant have been evacuated to Russian territory. They are now able to open up and maintain that land bridge from Crimea into the Donbass. What does this latest development do for Russia that it hasn't been able to do thus far?
The first thing is that they can claim a major success, a major take of a city that was of strategic and tactical importance to them. That provides a great morale boost and propaganda boost for President Putin that they actually succeeded in taking one of their strategic city objectives that they've been fighting for quite some time. The more important tactical or operational level is that their supply line logistics are going to be now complete.
That's Flashpoint Ukraine Steve Miller speaking with Craig Albert, a political science professor at Augusta University in Georgia. African countries are being encouraged to use both soft and hard power to counter the growing threat posed by Islamic State. The U.S. government is giving more than $100 million to African states to overcome terrorism. As Mohamed Yusuf reports, top U.S. security officials say African leadership and voice is vital.
Last week, security leaders from the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS pledged to support African security agencies in dealing with the terrorist activities of the Islamic State. The coalition, which has 85 members, met in Morocco to discuss ways of dislodging fighters allied to ISIS from Mali, Burkina Faso, Mozambique and several other African countries. Terror activities by these militants have increased in recent years, killing tens of thousands and displacing millions, creating a humanitarian crisis. Chris Landberg is a State Department's acting principal deputy coordinator for counterterrorism. Landberg says some African governments will receive millions of dollars to improve their efforts in fighting terrorism.
So we are increasing this every year, and we're looking to use it to improve capabilities of our partner civilian law enforcement and judiciary, goals of disrupting, apprehending, prosecuting, and convicting terrorists across the continent.
Akinola Olojo, a senior researcher at the Institute for Security Studies, says the ISIS affiliates in Africa are different from each other and will require tailored strategies to defeat them.
While we recognize that there seems to be a similarity at a certain level. In a different way, we see that even the actors involved or the insecurity actors involved, as well as the way they relate with communities and the way they sort of act against the state, takes different expressions. And we need to understand these nuances in order to have approaches that can adequately match what is manifesting in the different contexts.
The Deputy Special Envoy for the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS, Doug Hoyt, said countering the militants' messaging is critical.
So the coalition itself probably continue to launch platforms against what we see as vulnerable youth, certainly in the Sahel and Trans-Sahara region. So what we're emphasizing with communications is it's not top-down, it's bottom-up. So we start at the local level and we work with member governments, and we tailor these messaging in language and customs and traditions and what's going on here. And we very much want the African members out front on that.
The UN Global Counterterrorism Strategy, an instrument meant to enhance the international effort to counter terrorism, calls for nations to address the conditions terror groups use to spread terrorism. It also aims at building the state's capacity to prevent and combat terrorism while adopting measures to respect human rights and the rule of law. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
A report by Human Rights Watch finds civilians in Burkina Faso are suffering from an increase in attacks by armed Islamist groups and government security forces. The conflict has displaced millions and increased recruitment into armed groups as Anika Hamashlag reports from Dakar, Senegal.
The escalating attacks include widespread killings, rapes, and the pillaging of goods, according to the report. The conflict began in 2016 and has since destabilized nearly the entire Sahel region. But Burkina Faso has seen the worst of the violence, and conditions are deteriorating. Nearly 600 people were killed between January and April of this year, triple the number in the same period in 2021, according to the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project. The number of people displaced has also risen, reaching more than 1.8 million by the end of February of this year, a more than 4% increase since the end of January. In addition to terrorist groups, government security forces have become increasingly abusive and subjected civilians to unlawful killings and abductions, the report said. Corinne Dufka is the West Africa director for Human Rights Watch. She says she's covered Burkina Faso for years and is particularly concerned by new atrocities being committed that she hadn't seen before.
Notably, the rape of girls and women. I documented dozens of cases of girls and women who were sexually abused and beaten as they foraged for wood, as they went back and forth to market, and as they fled their villages from fighting.
Other new abuses include the recruitment of child soldiers, the use of mortars to target villages, and the placement of IEDs along main roads. The explosive devices have killed dozens of civilians and impeded the delivery of humanitarian aid. Burkina Faso's elected government was overthrown in January by military forces that blamed then-President Roch-Marc Christian Kabore for the rise in jihadist-linked violence. But in the more than 3 months since the coup, the junta itself has failed to reverse the trend and restore peace and stability. In early April, transitional president Lieutenant Colonel Ponori Sandaogo Damiba said he was implementing a new strategy that would show results within 5 months. The changes include replacing heads of command, improving equipment, and calling in retired military personnel. Fahiraman Rodrigue-Kone is a senior Sahel researcher with the Institute for Security Studies in Bamako. He said counterterrorism operations have been undermined by corruption and a lack of coordination.
We all know that this fighting against jihadist militant group won't be achieved by military way. So if there is serious dialogue, community-based dialogue, this will be a good option.
Kone said he expects some improvement in the security situation as the government now appears to be considering peace talks. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
In other news, the U.S. Soccer Federation has reached a milestone agreement to pay its men's and women's teams equally. That makes the American national governing body the first in the sport to promise both sexes completely matching compensation. The Federation has announced separate collective bargaining agreements through 2028 with the unions for both national teams. The move ends years of often acrimonious negotiations. One of the main sticking points was World Cup prize money. The unions agreed to pool FIFA payments for the men's World Cup this year and next year's Women's World Cup. It will also pool the 2026 and 2027 tournaments. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Adofo in Washington. The United Nations says the war in Ethiopia's Tigray region means more than 1 million children are missing out on school. In neighboring regions, schools are reopening as fighters and displaced people that occupy them leave, but some are dealing with grim challenges while their students face trauma. Henry Wilkins reports from Gahina, Ethiopia.
A total of 1.39 million children in the Tigray region are currently missing out on education due to Ethiopia's civil war, according to the United Nations. While journalists are banned from entering Tigray, VOA was able to access the neighbouring Amhara region, where schools are beginning to reopen after Tigrayan forces that occupied much of the region withdrew in December. But the occupation left deep scars. Residents in the town of Gashena say Tigrayan forces used the classroom as a base, left graffiti on classroom walls, insulting the Amhara ethnic group and Ethiopia's prime minister, and dumped bodies into a mass grave on school grounds. The TPLF has denied such allegations and called for an independent investigation. One of the students, Aiten Mune, recounts returning to the school after the Tigrayan forces had left. He says when he returned to the school, there were bloodstains, broken desks, broken computers here and there. The TPLF had used the school as a hospital, which is why there was so much blood, he explains. The deputy headmaster of the school, Getnet Habtamu, said he had to mobilise local authorities to exhume the mass grave filled with soldiers and civilians killed during the fighting because of the psychological impact it had on students. He said students refused to attend because the school was a total mess and that there was blood all over the place. He adds that the community worked together to bring the students back to school, but teachers had to go door to door to the students' house to convince them to come back. Farther north, near the town of Sokoto, the UN provides schooling for children displaced by the conflict, but many of them, like Batukan Gebrat, have been traumatised from witnessing the fighting. She says her brother was killed in an explosion while he was playing with his friend and that she has seen many, many bad things. I even saw people killed after having their limbs cut off, she says. Yasmin Sharif, the director of Education Cannot Wait, a UN-funded non-profit, says education can play an essential part in helping children like Batukan and Mune build resilience to trauma. She spoke to VOA over Zoom.
You see family members, parents, siblings, raped, killed, injured, and a child during the formative years, see all this violence or even are the subject of the violence, will logically become traumatized. And that's why mental health and psychosocial services are another very existential, life-saving component of education.
She adds, while food security and access to water are essential to people displaced by war, education is also essential in the long term if countries are to build back effectively and avoid future conflict. For the nearly 1.4 million students entering their third school year disrupted by war in Tigray, the consequences will likely be felt for the rest of their lives. Henry Wilkins.
Pope Francis recently joked with seminarians about needing some alcohol to deal with severe pain in his knee. He recently cancelled a foreign trip because of the ailment, sparking speculations about his declining health. Sabina Casofranco reports from Rome.
Pope Francis has been suffering from pain in his right knee due to strained ligaments in recent weeks, which has also forced him to use a wheelchair on more than one occasion. Doctors have also prescribed physical therapy to help him with his ailment. But following his general audience this week, he seemed to think there was something else that could help him with his pain. He was riding on his Pope Mobile at the end of the audience when some Mexican seminarians shouted out to him, asking him how he was doing with his knee. The exchange between the Pope and the seminarians went viral when Francis said he could use some tequila to deal with his knee pain. The seminarians asked him in his native Spanish how his knee was doing, and Francis responded it was capricious. The Pope said, "Do you know what I need for my knee? A little tequila." The Mexicans laughed heartily and promised to bring Pope Francis a bottle of the potent liquor, considered Mexico's national drink, the next time they pay a visit to the Santa Marta residence in the Vatican, where Francis lives. The faithful saw the Pope limping badly when he was presiding at ceremonies recently for the Easter festivities. He uses a cane to walk. There have been concerns that at 85 years of age, the Pope's health is not what it used to be when he was elected more than 9 years ago. But close advisers have rejected any speculation that the Pope is generally unwell. Argentine Bishop Victor Manuel Fernandez from La Plata met with the Pope on May 14th and later tweeted, "He's in very good health and the same lucid reflection as always." Pope Francis has a busy travel schedule for the remainder of this year with confirmed trips to the Democratic Republic of Congo and South Sudan in early July and a separate trip to Canada later the same month. Still, doubts have persisted after he recently cancelled a planned 2-day trip to Lebanon in June due to his knee problem. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
And to all our VOA listeners, please note we have moved our programs to a new website, voaafrica.com, from voanews.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com, and thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and a panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is calling on allies to boost their economic support for Ukraine, saying the support pledged so far will not be enough to meet the country's basic needs. This topic and more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voaafrica.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Afo in Washington, wishing you a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
An Istanbul court sentenced Turkish civil rights activist and philanthropist Osman Kavala to life in prison for allegedly attempting to overthrow the government. Kavala was first arrested in 2017 on charges related to the 2013 Gezi Park protests in Istanbul. The demonstrations grew into a nationwide year-long movement against then-Prime Minister Recep Erdogan's increasingly authoritarian rule. A court later acquitted Kavala of the Gezi Park charges and ordered Kavala released. He was immediately rearrested on charges of taking part in a 2016 coup attempt against President Erdogan, which resulted in the death of at least 250 people and the eventual detention of over 110,000 people, including civil servants, teachers, activists, and journalists. In addition to Kavala, the Turkish court sentenced seven other defendants to 18-year prison sentences for aiding the attempted overthrow of the Erdogan government. Among them was 71-year-old architect Mujalla Yepici, Istanbul municipality urban planner Tayfun Kahraman, and documentary filmmaker Çiğdem Mater. The United States is deeply troubled and disappointed by the court's decision to convict Osman Kavala, among others. His unjust conviction is inconsistent with respect for human rights, fundamental freedoms, and the rule of law, said State Department spokesperson Ned Price in a statement. We again call on Turkey to release Osman Kavala in keeping with European Court of Human Rights rulings, as well as to free all others arbitrarily incarcerated. The United States remains gravely concerned by the continued judicial harassment of civil society, media, political, and business leaders in Turkey, including through prolonged pretrial detention, overly broad claims of support for terrorism, and criminal insult cases. The people of Turkey deserve to exercise their human rights and fundamental freedoms without fear of retribution, declared spokesperson Price. The right to exercise freedom of expression, peaceful assembly, and association is enshrined in Turkey's constitution and its international law obligations and Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe commitments. We urge the government to cease politically motivated prosecutions and to respect the rights and freedoms of all Turkish citizens.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.